law school, baby. It all starts here.
Caleb Parsons is 6'9 swingman. You can shoot the three.
This is why you don't teach lessons.
Exactly. You basketball fans are terrible and shameful. Hello and welcome to the Alligator Sports Podcast. This is the show for Wednesday, March 25th, 2009. I'm Adam Berry, the assistant sports editor and softball beat writer here at Alligator Sports. And with me today are
Mike McCall, football beat writer and columnist.
Kyle Maestri, baseball beat writer.
Basketball beat writer. Mike DiFernando.
Bobby Colobi, baseball beat writer.
All right, and we got a lot of stuff to talk about here. We're going to first touch on football stuff. Spring practice starts tomorrow, Wednesday, and we also got some basketball to talk about. Probably going to talk a little bit about the women's team and their the end of their season. But let's start, most importantly, with football. McCall, spring practice starts today, technically Wednesday. Tell us what to expect out of it.
Yeah, the big things to watch this year are going to be refilling the wide receiver positions where they lost Percy Harvin, Lewis Murphy, and also Cornelius Ingram, the tight end, even though he didn't play last year. Those are all really big gaps they're going to have to fill in the offense, especially with Harvin, because they said they don't want to change the offense even though he's gone, so they've got to find somebody who can take all the direct snaps and do all the things Percy Harvin did in the offense. That's going to be the biggest challenge for them this year. But first, they've got a lot of injuries, a really long list of injuries, actually. The players who will be limited in spring practice are Carlos Dunlop, Taryn Sanders, Brendan Beal, Carl Johnson, James Wilson, a few other ones that don't really matter too much, to be honest with you. And then some guys who have already been ruled out who are notable. Brandon Antoine, really sad story, had that back muscle problem, came back from it, then he tore his ACL last year, so he's out for spring practice. Brandon Hicks, that's kind of a big deal. He's a really good linebacker. Mike Pouncey, that's another big one. Omarius Hines, a wide receiver who I know Bobby's really high on, redshirted last year, got really big. That's good, but he's got a weird thigh problem that actually made wide receivers coach Pilly Gonzalez laugh about. So we'll see. We'll see how that turns out. And then Brandon James had surgery on his right foot, so he's out. But let's go around and see what you guys think about the wide receivers. Give me a breakout wide receiver this year who you think is going to really impress people.
Well, I think Deontay Thompson's going to be that guy just because. I think he's going to become the big play guy in the offense. DeBose has that chance too, but I just don't know what we're going to get out of him yet because he's going to be a freshman. I think Deontay is who I'm going to go with, but I think Hernandez takes over as like the catch guy. He's going to get the most catches, I think.
Right, well, I agree with Kyle that Deontay Thompson's probably going to be the go-to guy that fills in for the, you know, the guys that left. But another guy I'm going to throw out there is Frankie Hammond. He had a really good fall, if I remember correctly, and I think he redshirted last year, but I think he's someone to look out for too.
Like Mike mentioned, I'm very high on Omarius Hines. His high school coach, when I talked to him, actually had said one interesting thing that he goes up and gets the ball. And if you watch any highlights of him from high school, he has no problem going into traffic and making a catch. But since he's out, it's going to be a little bit harder for him to actually crack that lineup. So I agree with Deontay Thompson, although he did this last spring. He broke out, had a great spring, and then just didn't get play time in fall. So he's going to have to make sure to carry a good spring over into the fall again. And Andre DeBose is obviously going to make an impact.
Yeah, I've got to agree with Deontay Thompson. He's definitely like the odds-on favorite to really make an impact this year. Also, yeah, I think Andre DeBose is going to be really good. I think he's going to step in and really make an impact. Kind of, I'm not going to say he's the next Percy Harvin or that he is Percy Harvin, but I'm going to say his freshman year will be somewhat comparable to Harvin's, where he's not the main guy, but he breaks some plays. He opens up the offense. That's the most important thing that he can do. And also, let's not forget about David Nelson. He had a great end of the year. I think he's going to carry that momentum over. He's a big guy, more of like a possession receiver. You're not going to get a whole lot of like down the field stuff from him. But if you have Riley Cooper, if you have Deontay Thompson who can stretch the field vertically, that helps out guys like David Nelson a lot.
Yeah, I think you're right on there because I think you're right about DeBose. He's not going to be the guy, but he'll show flashes of the ability to be the guy down the road. I think that's a really good point. And with David Nelson, you know, the guy on that 2016 when Percy came in was Dallas Baker. He was really the go-to receiver out of all the receivers. And I think David Nelson compares pretty favorably to him. I don't know what you guys think, but, you know, big receiver, good in the red zone, that type of receiver. He's not going to maybe break long plays after the catch or anything like that, but he's a big target, and I think he can rack up a lot of catches.
I mean, one of the biggest things that DeBose is going to bring is someone who's multidimensional. Because, I mean, they have quick receivers that can go across the middle, take slants. They have fast running backs who are going to be able to run the option. But the thing Percy provided was that uncertainty of what he was going to do. Is he going to go out for a pass? Is he going to run the ball? And DeBose can provide that a little bit. It's the fact that you can line him up and defense are not going to be sure what to expect from him.
Yeah, I think Bobby's right. DeBose is going to be the Percy Harvin type guy. I think Deontay Thompson is going to be more of an Andre Caldwell type receiver. fast, runs really good routes, can go deep, and not necessarily run the ball as much as maybe DeBose will.
Yeah, and I think, does anyone disagree with that Aaron Hernandez will be their best receiver?
Absolutely
yeah.
not. No.
Yeah, I mean, you could see that last year when they started going to him a lot. And I think, unquestionably, their most unstoppable play is the shovel pass to Aaron Hernandez.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen anyone guard that. The only time I've seen Florida fail running that play was with Chris Leak against Arkansas in the SEC Championship when he got pick six by a D lineman. But Aaron Hernandez was not involved in the play, and Chris Leak's gone. So I think that's going to be a huge play. You're going to see that a lot more. They go to it in clutch situations.
Yeah.
Also, one name that hasn't been mentioned is Riley Cooper. He will be back. Urban Meyer loves his blocking ability, and Tebow seems to like throwing it to him. So he's going to also need to step up. I mean, he's played a big role, but not a dominating role. He's going to have to step up next year.
Yeah, I don't really know what we're going to get out of Cooper. That's an interesting storyline too. But with a shovel pass, I'm going to go ahead and say something horrible happens on that play one time next year, though. Because with how often they went to it in crunch time, you got to be game planning for it if you're the other team at this point. Like, you have to say you're going to need to mark Hernandez coming off the line in the first 5 yards there. And I just think something bad is going to happen one time where Tebow just Chris leaks it up and throws it to the other team. And, you know, maybe it goes for six or something like that. But I could see that play backfiring.
I got to say, I've seen the exact thing you're talking about right now. I saw Tebow do it twice in high school. And at both times he was pick six by none other than Jock Rickerson. So I'll keep that in mind.
Nice.
And one other thing I was going to say, we did not mention Carl Moore. What do you guys think about Carl Moore? Massive disappointment last year. I couldn't help but think when Bobby was talking about Amarius Hines footage from high school, he goes up and gets the ball, and he's physical, and he's really good. That's what Carl Moore was. Carl Moore was supposed to be this freak. I mean, they even potentially committed a recruiting violation with his girlfriend, the gymnast, and all that didn't pay off at all. He did nothing last year. He did squat. They need to see him.
He did so little that my nickname for him last year was the intended receiver, just for the number of times we heard Carl Moore, the intended receiver.
That is great.
I'm going to say that Carl Moore will be replaced by David Nelson in the starting lineup. I think he's going to be the big, physical, tall guy that's going to catch those balls and not Moore.
Yeah, I mean, Carl Moore has never really been in the starting lineup, though. He didn't do anything to earn that or even come close to that. He's the guy right now who's on, like, the outside looking in, has to, like, work his way into the lineup.
What do we think is the depth chart right now? Like, who's one, who's two? What do we think?
It's so hard to say. I mean, Billy Gonzalez talked about this on Pro Day when Harvin and Murphy were working out for NFL scouts, that, like, he really doesn't know what he's going to get. He has, like, a whole pack of receivers. But the one thing that's encouraging to him is he said at one of the workouts, he lined everybody up, got everybody in a huddle, and he said, I want you to raise your hand if you've accomplished everything you wanted to at the University of Florida. And he said nobody raised their hands. And he was like, that's exactly how it should be, because none of these guys – have really done anything. I mean, David Nelson and Riley Cooper had some big catches at the end of the year last year. But before that, David Nelson was labeled as a waste of a scholarship by Urban Meyer. So it's not like these guys have had great careers. They haven't really done anything yet. And that's the one unit on this team that's really going to have to step up this year, because every other unit's in really good shape.
I mean, entering the season, or entering the spring at least, I think the top three are going to be Thompson, Nelson, Cooper. What order, I'm not really sure, but since there's usually three receivers on the field, I don't think you need too much in order. And as for Carl Moore,
we don't think he can beat out Riley Cooper.
The thing with him is, I want to say that they messed up recruiting him. They didn't get enough film of him. They didn't get to see him in person. Because supposedly, when he arrived on campus, he was 2-3 inches shorter than what they thought he would be. Which, wow. That's something, if you meet someone, you notice 2-3 inches. So I feel as though that's something, when you're recruiting a guy, you got to notice.
Yeah, but he was a campus guy. He was a 5-star JUCO transfer
everybody
athlete.
Well, one of the things was that he's a freak athlete for the size he was bringing. Mm-hmm. And when you go from 6'4 all of a sudden to 6'1, 6'2, not really bringing that size, that dominating size anymore.
Are you saying that they never met him before he came to campus?
I'm worried they might not have. Just
how is
because
that possible? How could you possibly?
He was in California.
They definitely met him. They might not have watched him play in person, which is a big deal. You're right about that. But I think they definitely had to have met him.
As far as ranking the receivers, like 1, 2, 3, whatever, I think it doesn't matter at all. Because I think going into the season, they're not going to have a guy who catches for 1,000 yards. They're going to have a bunch of guys who catch for 400, 500, 600 yards. And honestly, I think that's good for them. Like, there's help. Nothing's better than team competition. All these guys are going to know, like, we have to make plays when we get our hands on the ball and when it's our time. And I think that that's going to inspire a good receiver by committee for the season going forward. And it doesn't need to be one guy carrying the load. I think with a number of options, it'll work well for them. And they're so loaded at that position, it's also good that if a guy goes down with an injury, it doesn't completely take them out of it.
Also, they have so many different packages and formations that they run that it doesn't matter. I mean, you'd see times last year where, like, Kate Casey's on the field before Aaron Hernandez, or when Manuel Moody starts in the backfield and then doesn't touch the ball for, like, three quarters. I mean, it all depends on what they want to start the game, and it has nothing to do, really, with the depth chart order.
Right, I'm like, well, you've seen Riley Cooper more than I have up close in practice and stuff, but I'm going to say that I've never really been all that impressed with Riley Cooper. I know he's had a couple big catches here and there, but he's kind of done more bad than good in his time at Florida. This is a rough stat, but in my mind, I feel like he's been responsible for like half of Tebow's career interceptions.
There was a point in 2007, the Heisman, Tebow's Heisman Trophy year, where Tebow's first like three picks, I think, were all Riley Cooper's fault for running the wrong route, for doing something wrong. And that's when I said he can only run a fly route. If you're not running Riley Cooper on a fly route, you're making a huge mistake. But this year he came out of that. If you saw in the Alabama game, there's one time when Florida was backed up, I want to say on their own like 5-yard line. It was a third down, I think, like a third and eight. Cooper ran this great comeback route, totally torched whatever corner he was on, left him like way in the dust, got the first down. That was the kind of possession receiver catch and play that you never saw Riley Cooper make. And then he had the quick slant, you know, catch to put that game away. Mm-hmm. Those are the kind of things you didn't see from him, and you're starting to see them come out now. My only question is, with him getting back into the swing of things with baseball, missing most of spring practice, how's that going to affect him when he comes back?
Well, hopefully he doesn't take his strikeouts onto the football field with him. You know how they say you don't want you to take your strikeouts into the field, your bats in the field, so we'll see. But as far as him running the wrong route and stuff like that, even if he did run the wrong routes, I felt like I didn't respect Tebow for, like, saying that or, like, it coming out that way. I feel like he should have been like, oh, I threw it, it was my fault. Like,
he didn't
whatever.
Really
I felt
it.
Like
he didn't say it. It was more of like it came from like Mullen and Meyer, like, well, the ball was where it was supposed to be when it was supposed to be.
Okay.
There.
I thought there was a quote where Tebow was like, yeah, Riley ran the wrong route.
I mean, he may have said it one time, but like if he did run the wrong route, then he did. You know, I mean, it's not Tebow saying like Tebow's not the kind of guy who's gonna say like, well, you know, that's not on me. You know, like,
I have a lot of respect for him. I'm just saying, like, behind the scenes, I don't mind him going into him being like, yo, you ran the wrong route, like, you need to fix that. Yeah. I'm not taking another INT. But I think, like, it's not important, like, who was right in the media or, like, with fans and stuff. So, I don't know.
One other guy who came in as a wide receiver, switched to safety, coming back to wide receiver now is Justin Williams. He was my boy. I still really like Justin Williams. I really hope he does something this year. But also one of the other big position switches going into the spring, Matt Patchen, highly recruited offensive lineman, played defensive lineman also in high school some. Got shot in the shoulder, rehabbed, came back, played on the D-line last year, did a pretty good job. I know Dan McCarney, the defensive line coach, was really high on Patchen, really didn't want to give him up, but he has because Patchen's gone back to offense. And I've also heard he might be in a few two tight end packages.
Ooh.
I'm not sure if he'll be catching the ball or not, but we'll see.
I mean, it's not. I was a little surprised at first when I heard he'd be possibly playing some tight end, but he is very undersized for a tackle. Even when he put on weight, he was still undersized. So he's got, I mean, it's so tough without the depth they have going in at defensive tackle for them just to move him over. But he is an offensive lineman. They recruit him as an offensive tackle. They don't want to just throw him to defense and give up on him completely on offensive tackle. So if for some reason the depth on defensive tackle is not where they want to be, there's no question that they will move him back in.
All right, one more question about this before we move on to something else. We're talking about the receiving game. What are the guys coming out of the backfield back during the Demps, the Rainey, and the screen passes and all that?
Big time. And Gonzalez talked about that too. He was like, you know, we don't have to find a guy to fill Harvin's role because there's guys coming out of the backfield that can do it too. So I think you're just going to see more spread out, like, array of weapons this year, which is going to be really fun to watch. Although the one thing I'm kind of worried about is in the SEC championship game when Harvin wasn't there, Demps and Rainey were much less effective, especially Demps.
Yeah.
Because when you don't have Harvin on the field, I know Kyle Shanahan said he loves Jeff Demps. I like him too. He's cool. But when you don't have Harvin on the field and you don't have the defense all throwing their attention to that one guy, I think that's what's important for them. They don't have to have the one guy doing everything Harvin did, but it helps because it draws so much attention from the defense.
Jeff Demps, a guy that we tried to nickname earlier this spring, I believe.
Oh, that's right.
Did the gingerbread man ever make the official nickname list?
Is that what won? I should know.
You never wrote a call about this.
The gingerbread man is without question the best one but the best feedback that we got in about the column. That is unbelievably
great.
Whoever did
great
that to the
there was another good one, right?
Takes it to the gingerbread house.
We had some
Yeah, that's right.
Just awesome.
Well, we had a
We got a lot of potential with that Gingerbread Man nickname here. Are we ready to move on here?
Well, one last thing I was going to say. If you're interested in going to watch spring practice, I'd recommend that you don't. But if you would like to, Wednesday, that's today potentially if you're listening to this early.
Or yesterday.
Yeah, it starts at 3:25, ends at 5:55. Same thing on Friday the 27th. Saturday it'll be 10 a.m. to 12:40 p.m. And hopefully sometime after that we'll have another podcast. So stay tuned.
So with this podcast and a time machine, you can get out to Wednesday spring practice.
Yes, exactly.
Hopefully this was the first thing you downloaded when you woke up today, Wednesday morning. All right, we're going to move on to here. Something I got in front of me. It's a piece of paper here which says, Urban Meyer's website, coachurbanmeyer.com, which I did not even know existed, has a blog. The blog is called Gator Bead. All right, on and on and on. It has a tournament here called Gator Madness. It's the ultimate championship moment, 2006 versus 2008. A lot of big moments from that. You can see the clips online, I believe, at the site. Mike, you brought this to us. Explain this to us.
Yeah, this is Urban Meyer's website, like you said, and they have a blog. I'm sure Urban Meyer had little to nothing to do with this. So what they did basically was they picked eight moments each from the 2006 and 2008 national championship teams, seeded them 1 through 8, put them on two sides of a bracket. You can go in there, watch the YouTube clips, and vote on what you think, and then it'll advance it through the rounds, and they'll come out with a champion, which will undeniably have something to do with Tim Tebow, but let's hope not. So what I'm going to do is read through the matchups, tell you the play, and then run around the room real quick and see what you guys think. If someone said something ridiculous, we'll slap you down. The first matchup, the number one seed in the, I guess, the West region of the bracket, is Tebow's promise against Ole Miss last year, his heartfelt apology after losing to Ole Miss, blah, blah, blah. You already know about that. The number eight seed is his jump pass to Tate Casey against LSU in 2006. UF was down 7-0. Tebow had a 1-yard touchdown run to tie the game, and then he had the 1-yard jump pass to Tate Casey to put them ahead 14-7. They never trailed again. They won 23-10. There are a lot of other big plays and moments in that game also. But that was kind of what started the Tebow legend, was his rushing touchdown and the jump pass. It's really gotten out of hand since then. So, Kyle, what you got in that match?
Without question, Tebow's speech that sparked the national championship. Jamarcus Russell did a great job of losing that game on his own. So, without question, speech.
And let's not forget Riley Cooper's hit on the kickoff in the second half. Didn't he hit the guy in the end zone?
Yes.
Jermaine McCollum.
Early Doucette, I think it was.
Tackling for safety. Yeah. Well, does anyone disagree that Tebow's promise wins that matchup?
Hope not.
The next matchup we got Dallas Baker against his protege, David Nelson. The David Nelson jump pass touchdown that sealed the national championship game this year, that made it 24-14 with 3 minutes left. So it didn't put them ahead, but it put the game out of reach. And then Dallas Baker's touchdown, if you remember, they were tied 14-0 with FSU, the last regular season game in 2006. It was one of those games that you could tell Florida's better and Florida probably going to win, but they never pulled away until Chris Lee kicked Dallas Baker in the back of the end zone, 25-yard pass. Still 10 minutes left, a lot of time, but that game really sucked. It ended 21-14. What you got, Kyle?
The selection committee did a great job with this matchup, but I'm going to go with David Nelson. It was just a bigger game for me, so he gets it.
Yeah, David Nelson. The Dallas Baker touchdown isn't even my most memorable moment from that Florida State game. Earlier in that game, Percy Harvin had a touchdown run, and the announcer made a comment that Jared Faison said earlier in the week that Myron Roll stays with you for the first two steps and then strike up the band. And I'll never forget that comment. So that was way better in my mind.
And
so David Nelson wins.
And then I believe Myron Roll made a comment about how he was faster or as fast as Percy Harvin. And Myron took kind of a bad angle. He really Kyle Jackson'd that play. but Harvin still outran him to the end zone.
I think actually my most memorable moment was Reggie Nelson maybe had the hardest hit I've ever seen him make on the fullback down the sideline, where afterwards the fullback could not, they brought a chair for him to sit in afterwards because he could not get up from the hit. Nastiest hit I've ever seen him make.
Good memory.
But David Nelson's touchdown definitely wins here.
I'd agree. I'd take David Nelson's. And I agree with Kyle, too. 4-5 matchup. Really tight.
Yeah, great job.
So we're all job with coach. David Nelson on that. All right.
No Arizona's in this bracket.
The next one, we may have our first upset here. We've got Reggie Nelson interception against Tennessee on the first play. It's my favorite Reggie Nelson moment for sure. First play of the game, Reggie Nelson's basically playing the entire field at safety by himself. And he makes a pick almost on the sideline, jumping through the air. He's like totally horizontal to the ground. It was beautiful. That's on the first play. Florida went on to win 21-20. He also picked off Ainge's last pass of the game to kind of wrap that one up. And then the sixth seed going up against Nelson's pick is Percy Harvin's touchdown against LSU. It was on the first drive. It was 3rd and 12. Tebow threw a pass. It got tipped. Harvin picked it up, ran it in 70 yards, put him up 7-0. They never looked back.
Well, you'll see my line of thinking for all these matchups are generally the same. I think the Tennessee game was a much closer game. The LSU game was a beatdown. So by my logic, they needed the Reggie Nelson play more than they needed the Harvin play for that game. I know it was the first play of the game, but it was a very close game. They won 21-20.
Yeah.
One of the games that could have kept them out of the championship. And with the Harvin play also, Tebow made a horrible throw on that ball. So I just don't want to give it to a lucky fluke-type play where it gets deflected and he runs it in.
Yeah, the Eraser wins this one. That was one of the most iconic plays of Reggie Nelson's career and that season, in my opinion. He wins.
I agree that Harvin touchdown really did set the tone for that blowout, but so did Reggie Nelson's interception. It set the tone for U.S. tight victory over Tennessee. So I'm sticking with Reggie Nelson.
I'm going to go with Reggie Nelson as well. It's one of those plays that I can remember watching happen. Like, I remember where I was because that was such a big game, and I was living in Tennessee at the time. So.
You guys want to know what I remember watching? I remember watching Florida lose to Mississippi in the Swamp. I remember them going to Arkansas not being particularly impressive, and then I remember them coming home to play LSU. There were a lot of doubters. People didn't know what was going on. They start off with two bad plays. It's 3rd and 12. Things aren't looking good, and they have a miracle play to Harvin that busts it open. The Swamp's rocking. They romp for the rest of that game. And I think that sets the tone. If they punt there, I have no idea what happens.
They still win by 20.
Instead of 30. You don't know that. It's such a big momentum game. And that set the tone in a huge way. I think the Harvin play, I think that was huge. And from that moment on, after they beat down LSU, they rocketed up the polls. Everyone was all over Florida again. That was huge.
That was overrated LSU game heading into that game, by the way, too. Yeah. So.
Is Jared Lee and Andrew Hack still playing quarterback? Come on.
Go ahead with the next matchup. I'm just not even going to
argue. You guys
that.
Aren't even going to give that a response. No. I think, in my mind, that's not even close to me. I love the Reggie Nelson
play. That's crazy.
I really do.
How is that not even close? It was a 21-20 game. They barely sneaked out. It was on the road instead of at home, so it's more likely that they were going to lose that game than the LSU game. LSU ended up not being that good of a team, and they straight whooped them in the Swamp. It
ended up not being a good game, but when they were on the field at the same time, you didn't know that. It didn't matter. At the time, I think the Harvin play is bigger.
No, Kyle's right about that game being so much bigger. And if you really want to talk about when Tebow's, like, aura or whatever started, it was that game. Because Deshaun Winn on, like, 3rd and short, couldn't pick up a first down. And Tebow came in on 4th down and picked up the first down to ice that game. So
Yeah, that was an unfortunately large
impressive memory.
Also. All right, now we've got to, what are you going to say?
Yeah, real quick before we go into that, I thought the consensus was that, you know, the turnaround really started in the fourth quarter of that Arkansas.
Yeah, we're going to get to that. We're going to get to that later, okay. Actually. But that was like what, never mind. All right, the 7-2 matchup we got down here. Brandon Spikes is the 7 seed with his hit on Knowshon Moreno to start off the Georgia game, another big tone setter, which obviously you guys don't like. And then the 2 seed is Wandy Pierre-Louis, fumble recovery for a touchdown against Arkansas in the SEC championship game. That made it 24-21 Florida near the end of the third quarter.
I got something to say about this. All right, on the Wandy fumble recovery versus Arkansas, that was the worst coach drive in the history of Urban Meyer coaching Florida football. Never have I seen something so bad. They fake punted from, like, I think it was their own 20 on the field, got the first down in, like, a crazy move on 4th down. They burned a timeout in Urban Meyer-type fashion, just, you know, seemingly no reason. Then they push the ball up to midfield, and it's like 4th and 2 at approximately midfield, maybe they're on 45, and they call another timeout right there. So they burn 2 timeouts, and instead of punting it, you're like, okay, instead of going for it, because you're like, okay, they're going to get a play together. I don't have a problem with that timeout because they're going to get a good play that they want on 4th down. Urban Meyer sends the punt team out there. They punt it, so they burn 2 timeouts and a fake on that drive just to punt. And then it all gets wiped away by the Wandy, like, fumble recovery on Fish, was it?
Yeah,
fumbled it?
Reggie Fish.
And it wasn't like he forced it either. He just dropped it and Wandy falls on it. So, like, I think that play was kind of big, but just for, like, the sheer ridiculousness and, like, not great football that led up to that, I'm going to give it to Spikes on Moreno. I know that was just one play, and I know that was a romp too, but I think it was a big play at the beginning of the game. Moreno was clearly their best player, and Spikes definitely sent a message in that one.
I agree that Wandy lucked into that play because Fish dropped the ball, but it's still a bigger play. It had way more to do with the outcome. It was way more pivotal.
I'm going with Kyle here. Spikes. I was just livid about that whole series that happened right leading up to that. And that Spikes hit, I had always thought Spikes would be a great NFL, but that one right there is what you hang your belt on. I mean, he was not... It's not like he was running right through him. He stood in the hole, waited for Moreno, and then just nailed him.
And then he let him know about it.
That's Moreno had all the momentum. Spikes had none, and Spikes just put him right on his
Was this the Wandy raindrop?
This was
the Wandy dance. So you get two nice after the play matchups here too. The Wandy rain dance versus the spikes, the kind of bump and grind. I know Sean Moreno.
I'm gonna go with the spikes hit as well, just for the momentum it set of that game. Like, you know, when going into that game, it was like, oh man, this was so huge last year. How are they gonna respond? That's how they responded.
I'm gonna go with spikes also. One thing, we can't have.
I did not see that.
No, absolutely. Yeah, the spikes play was huge, and I don't think you can this actually goes in line with my previous statement about Percy Harvin. You can't, even though the Reggie Nelson interception was a tone setter too, just because the game was a blowout, you can't discount a great play in the beginning of the game. I mean, blowouts start somewhere, and momentum starts somewhere, and these are plays that set momentum, and they're also very memorable. I mean, all these plays are great, and I think the spikes one especially was huge. Let's move over to the other side of the bracket. The number one seed opposite of Tebow's speech is Jarvis Moss's block of Ryan Succop's 48-yard field goal against South Carolina that clinched a 17-16 win as time expired. That's going up against, it doesn't really matter, but it's going up against Brandon James' 78-yard punt return against Tennessee this year to make it 17-0 in the first quarter. Now, it's not going to get a lot of talk because we're probably just going to run around this real quick, but Brandon James' punt return was incredible against Tennessee. I mean, no one's going to pick that, I hope. But he juked somebody so bad, a little stop and start move.
Yeah,
everybody in the press box was like wowed by it.
Now that you were talking about the stop and start move, I do remember it, but I'm going to say I didn't really explicitly remember this one or like what he had to do to get the touchdown. Like, Moss's play is just so far and away more memorable and more impact.
Yeah, I think we're all going to go with the Moss play. We'll talk about that later when it's in a meeting.
You have to add in with that, with the punt return. Tennessee sucked. So it's
they were not good. All right, now we're going to get to the best matchup on this bracket by far. It's a 4-5 matchup. The four, you've got linebacker Earl Everett's helmetless tackle on Ohio State quarterback Troy Smith in the national championship in 2006. And then five, this isn't really fair to combine them, but the goal line stops against Oklahoma this year. The first one being Torrey Davis tackling Chris Brown on 4th-and-1 from the one, which was a big play. And then Oklahoma's next possession, they drove down again. Major Wright made an interception on a tipped ball. That brought it to the half at a tie instead of Oklahoma getting the two touchdowns they probably should have had. So those were both huge. Kyle, what you got?
Yeah, this is definitely a good matchup. I like the fact that they're both in championship games, so it has the same type of impact as far as the enormity of the game. But even if you broke it down to just Torrey Davis's stop for me, I think I still would pick that one just because I remember watching Oklahoma with the ball, and Chris Brown was just killing them. They could not stop the run. I feel like up until that goal line stop that they got. So I felt like that was a huge play. The game was much tighter. I'm definitely going with Oklahoma. I think the Everett helmetless tackle was very memorable and very kind of iconic, but like, it just, the game was too far apart and it wasn't in a big moment in the game.
I agree that the Oklahoma stops are probably more important to them winning the game because the Everett tackle kind of came after the game was already out of hand. But I think that's such a memorable play. There's posters of that tackle with him running with the dreadlocks flowing, throwing Troy Smith to the ground. So I think that's the most memorable moment maybe out of this entire bracket. So I'm going with Earl Everett.
I mean, I agree. The Everett tackle is extremely memorable. It was one of the coolest moments of that game. But if either of those goal line stops fails, then the outcome of the game is most likely going to be completely different. So you have to go with the Oklahoma stops.
I'm going to agree with that. I'm going to go with the Oklahoma stops. Like you said, just because of the direct impact they had on the game. I mean, the Everett moment was very cool, you know, and everybody remembers it, but difference in the game was the goal line stops.
I'm going to go with Earl Everett. I mean, that was the first time Florida really straight up pwned somebody in a game, and the thing you remember from that is the defensive line and the linebackers really hassling Troy Smith all night. The defense was all over the field. They shut down the Buckeyes. And, I mean, you even see bumper stickers in Gainesville still that say honk if you sacked Troy Smith. And that's what people remember. But the one thing you remember to sum all that up is Earl Everett's helmetless tackle. I mean, the effort. He was all over the place, even with the guy without his helmet still running down Troy Smith. I mean, that's what I remember. But on the vote, we're going to advance the goal line stops to Oklahoma. I'll do that grudgingly.
Well, I just want to say I'm not voting on memorableness. I'm voting on, like, the biggest impact play to me. That's how I'm voting. It led to a championship.
When they say ultimate championship moment on here, I mean, they didn't give us a great, like, definition of exactly what they're looking for, so we can do this however we want. But moment to me doesn't mean, like, most important play. It means, like, something you remember. Like, it's a memorable thing to me.
Well, I think inherently important plays are going to be remembered. But I think, like, when it comes down to it, the plays that are leading to wins and that are more important are definitely plays I'm going to vote for. We don't have to all vote the same way. I'm just making it clear where I'm coming from.
Let's do it this way if we can agree on this. In 15 years, if you're telling someone about the championship of whatever season and you're giving them like five plays. Oh, remember when this happened, when this happened, when this happened. What are you going to put above the other one?
All right, well, if we're going 15 years down the road, I'm going to say people will not remember the Oklahoma stops, and they will remember all ever, for sure.
I think they'll both be remembered, but I think like the more iconic thing to me is Earl Everett's helmetless tackle. But water under the bridge.
The Torrey Davis play was just so much more important that you should remember that one. That should be the one that you remember.
All right, moving on. 3-6 matchup. We've got Riley Cooper's touchdown against Alabama. He caught it on a quick slant, made the score 31-20 with 2:50 to play. Put the game away. It didn't give them the lead, but it put it away. He's going up against the 6th seed, Reggie Nelson, making his second appearance in this bracket. He had an interception for a touchdown against Alabama. It was 21-13 Florida. Alabama had the ball 2nd and 10 at the UF 46. Nelson pick sixes it from 70 yards out, makes it 28-13, and that was the final score.
I'm going to go with Riley Cooper here. Again, just a little bit of a bigger game. The impact was a little bit bigger. It was a tight one. And the Riley Cooper play was definitely the play that iced it for good. Like that was the play that you knew for sure they were going to win after Riley Cooper caught that ball. And also, if we were to advance Reggie Nelson, I feel like the travel situation would be real tough on him playing in two sides of the bracket at the same time, potentially. And it's just not good tournament work. So I'm going with Riley Cooper.
All right, well, the Reggie Nelson play was big, but that's not even my most memorable play from that game. The most memorable play from that game by far is the Chris League 40-yard scamper that almost got a touchdown but didn't.
That's definitely true.
That's maybe my most memorable Chris League moment ever.
Run, Chris, run.
Run, Chris, run. And also, for the record, those are the best uniforms Florida has ever worn. The throwback with the F on the helmet looked great. But Kyle's right. Cooper's touchdown was more meaningful. It got them to the title game, so Cooper's touchdown.
I know I'm probably going to be the only one to take this stance, but I'm actually going to go with the Reggie Nelson interception because by the time Cooper made that catch, I really felt as though, yeah, that iced it. But at that point, I really feel as though Florida was in control. They had that game. I just feel the defense at that point was already playing too well for the Alabama
score. What was the score when he caught that ball?
It was
they're up by 4, yeah?
Yeah. So it was 24-20.
So if they kick a field goal there, a touchdown still ties it. That was my thinking.
I just felt the defense at that point had too much confidence. They were making that stop. Reggie Nelson's, that came on, an 8-point game when Alabama was driving down the field. And whether or not he actually scored the touchdown, that interception finished that game off for good.
I'm going to go with the Cooper touchdown for a couple of reasons, some of which have already been mentioned here. But also, that was a game they played without Harvin. Like, there was a big question mark on who would step up there. And, I mean, Cooper was one of the guys who I personally did not expect, but he made it happen. That was a big catch for that game.
Yeah, I'm going to agree. Cooper's touchdown definitely put the game away. And that's the thing I'm going to remember from that game is Cooper catching the slant pass. I mean, that's the thing that's going to stand out to me. Our last matchup of the first round, we've got a 2-seed. One of my favorite plays, Ahmad Black's diving interception against Oklahoma when he ripped the ball away from, who was it, Joaquin Iglesias? Is that who it was? He totally beasted him. He's going up against the number 7 seed, which is Percy Harvin's 67-yard touchdown run in the SEC Championship against Arkansas. That was after the Wandy Rain Dance, Florida's next possession. On the first play, he takes a handoff 67 yards right up the middle. I remember the commentators going nuts over it when it happened. And Harvin ended up being named the MVP for that game. So what you got, Kyle?
Definitely Ahmad Black, no question. I'm staying consistent here. It's the bigger game. It's national championship versus SEC championship. Also, it looked like Oklahoma was going down the field on that drive. Joaquin Iglesias comes down with that. Looks like they're going to go in and score. Black completely turns it around for them. Pulls the ball away from Iglesias. It wasn't even – Bradford was actually throwing great. He had a couple tough luck interceptions. That was one of them. So it was guys making plays for Florida, and Ahmad Black was just huge.
Yeah, I agree. I think the Ahmad Black interception may have been the biggest play of that game. So I think it has to be that. That turned the tide for them.
Harvin won the MVP in that game, and Black should have won the MVP for not only that play, but he also caused the interception right before halftime on the goal line stand and made other crucial defensive stops. He should have won instead of Carlos Dunlap, who I think had one sack and maybe a blocked field goal or something. It was Black, in my opinion, was by far, hands down, the player of that game.
I'm going to go with the Black interception as well, just to round it out there.
Yeah, what I'll remember, going back to my Earl Everett helmetless tackle idea, like what I'll remember from the Oklahoma game is after Black picked that ball off, everyone's kind of like, wait, did he really catch that? Yeah. Is that really an interception? I just remember looking at Sam Bradford, and he looked like a kid whose puppy had just been taken from him. I mean, it was that is what I'll remember from that game. That was incredible. That was one of the best plays I've ever seen.
Right.
All right, so now we're going to move on to the second round. We've advanced our guys. Oh, before we do that, Let's get into some plays you think might have been left out, should have been on there. You mentioned the Chris Leak run. I know Bobby's got a good one. What you got, Bobby?
Adam briefly mentioned it. In my opinion, the biggest moment this season was not the Tebow speech. He might have said it, but I don't think he fully believed that this team could go in the championship run until he threw in the fourth quarter of the Arkansas game that touchdown pass to Percy Harvin. I mean, throughout that game, the Gators looked awful. Tebow looked like he had no confidence. In fact, even after that touchdown pass, he wasn't that, you know, had his, you know, that excited of, you know, himself. Like, Meyer, I think, had to give him a hug, you know, for throwing that pass. And that, in my opinion, completely turned around the season, not the speech.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you, except that I think he meant every word of his speech. I think he really still thought they were going to win a national championship. I don't want to discredit that, but I've been saying for a long time, I definitely think that play against Arkansas, beginning of the fourth quarter, I mean, they kind of already had the game won, but it wasn't very impressive. He hits Harvin on that slant across the middle, really tucked the ball in nicely into a little hole. And yeah, Urban Meyer ran on the field, gave him a chest bump because he said he didn't feel like Tebow had been having fun. He didn't feel like he was playing loose, like he had all this pressure on his shoulders from winning the Heisman Trophy, having like the weight of the world on his shoulders. And I think from that game on, you saw a different Tim Tebow. I thought that was the moment that the season turned around.
Well, I don't think that he had to necessarily believe they were going to win the national championship because he didn't say that. He didn't say that they were going to win that. He just said, I'm going to work as hard as anybody else or harder than anybody else is, and I'm going to make sure the team works harder than anybody else's. He never guaranteed results. He just said what their mindset was going to be. So I don't have a that's not the issue. But then with the Ahmad Black play, too, we were talking about moments that got left off, and we were talking about the debate between memorable and impact. The Ahmad Black play clearly the biggest impact to me in that game. But the major right hit on the first drive down the sideline of that game was so memorable to me because all the buildup in this game is Oklahoma's offense and their passing attack and Sam Bradford took the Heisman away and all these receivers they got. And major right, I don't remember the receiver he hit.
Emmanuel
Johnson. He straight killed the guy. It was unbelievable. It looked like Reggie Nelson out there.
After the game, I think one of them said, like, Emmanuel Johnson's still shaking or something like that.
Right.
One of the secondary guys.
Unbelievable hit. So that was a huge memorable moment for me. I think that could have snuck in maybe somewhere, so like the Brandon James punt return or something like that.
It's one of those tone setters you love so much. And
absolutely.
That
that's definitely a tone setter. That was big.
All right, well, I have a few kind of offbeat ones. I already talked about the Chris Leak run, which was awesome. I think Tim Tebow, 4th-and-1 against Tennessee after Deshaun Wynn's epic failure on 3rd down to ice that game. And also, this is kind of obscure, but I think you guys remember this. Reggie Nelson had one of the biggest hits I've ever seen in the LSU game in 2006 at home, and he jarred the ball loose, and Ryan Smith intercepted, and that kind of put that game out of reach. That was a huge play, too.
I've got another good one. This doesn't really – I mean, this is like a memorable Tebow moment. This goes in like the top 10 Tebow moments. Against Kentucky his freshman year when he came in to run, I think this is the game when they booed Chris Leak, but I'm not totally sure if it was the Kentucky game. But anyway, he takes the ball, runs up the middle, stiff-arms some poor Kentucky defensive back. I don't know who it was. And had him on a stiff arm for like 20 yards, ran him out of bounds, and then basically tackled the guy when they got on the sideline. That was incredible to me.
Well, first of all, no one ever booed Chris Leak. I don't understand this argument.
They booed
that they were taking Tebow off the
field. We can't get into this. We really can't get into this. So I'm just going to run past that. Right,
people
did
boo Chris Leak.
They did not.
But they foolishly.
Yeah, they shouldn't have, but they did.
All right, second round. We got Tebow's speech against David Nelson's jump pass catch against Oklahoma. I'm just going to advance the speech, probably.
Speech.
Staying on that side of the bracket, we got Reggie Nelson's flying interception against Tennessee against Brandon Spike's hit on Moreno.
Reggie Nelson advances again. Again, just such a close game, the 21-20 game. Brandon Spikes hit wall big. It was still in a blow. What ended up being a blowout. Georgia wasn't as good as we thought they were heading into the season. The Reggie Nelson play, they just needed more, and I'm going with Reggie Nelson.
But Reggie Nelson's pick did not come in like a crucial moment. Like I know
all moments of the game were crucial because it was so close. That's the argument I'm making.
Okay.
Reggie Nelson.
I'm actually going with Brandon Spikes just because I really feel as though the defense wasn't, getting the attention it deserved. And that moment really brought the defense to the forefront of everyone's, mind. Really set the tone for not only that game, but the rest of the season.
Are we a 2-2 split here? Am I the deciding?
You're going to be the deciding.
Yeah, you're
going to
be the deciding. I'm going Spikes on Moreno.
Make the right choice.
Don't let me down, Adam.
All right. I'm going to go with the Reggie Nelson.
Yes, you are, Adam Berry.
Clearly a smart man, Adam Berry.
That was a lot harder decision, though, if not for the pressure that was staring at me from both sides of the room here. But
just
also
Mike
because
was on my side, wasn't it?
That play shouldn't have even made it out of the first round. All right, going over to the other side of the bracket.
Oh, my goodness.
We've got Jarvis Moss field goal block against the goal line stops against Oklahoma. Moss. Yeah, okay.
Moss.
Yeah. I mean, I could go ahead and declare him the winner of the tournament, but
I want to have something to say about that later.
That's ridiculous. All right, then we've got the Riley Cooper slant touchdown against Alabama to seal the game, and Ahmad Black's interception against Oklahoma.
Black.
I'm going to go Cooper here. I think Cooper's play was much bigger than Black's. I think that iced the SEC title. They got them.
This one iced the national title.
No, but Riley, they couldn't even been in that game without Riley Cooper's touchdown.
They were in the game without their touchdown.
They were winning.
Okay, but Alabama gets the ball back. He doesn't make that touchdown. They're down four. They come down, like you said before, they can still tie it.
I mean, Ahmad Black's interception led to the drive that produced the jump pass to David Nelson that put the game away. So, I mean, if he doesn't take the ball away from him, If Iglesias still makes the catch, they have the ball at, like, you know, inside the 30-yard line. I'm not sure exactly where it was. I got to go with that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going with Black, and there was no question in my mind that Iglesias was making that catch.
Right.
That ball wasn't about to touch his fingers or just inches away from touching him. That was in his hands. That was firmly in his hands before Black took that away from him.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, he ripped it from his hands and, you know, took away a scoring drive.
I'm glad we really shut down deeper there. So I didn't want that picking up momentum.
We're in the final four here. We've got Tebow's speech against Reggie Nelson's interception against Tennessee. Does Reggie Nelson continue his miracle run?
Well, I think your attitude's way off on the Reggie Nelson play. That's neither here nor there. Speech.
All right, everybody
Although Reggie Nelson is a 3 seed, I don't think it's too much of a stretch.
For a while there, I thought Reggie Nelson was your Dayton of this bracket here, but I'm going to go.
I didn't have Dayton all the way.
One thing you got to keep in
mind. Game too far.
One thing you got to keep in mind with this bracket is they were so obsessed with making it equal. They made sure they got 8 of each. They made sure they had like the same number of the same seed. So there's each 06 and 08 each has a 1 seed, a 2 seed, a 3 seed, and a 4 seed. So that's how the Reggie Nelson interception got so overrated. Now, on the other side, or appropriately rated, depending on where you fall in this argument. On the other side, we've got the Moss cock block against Ahmad Black's interception against Oklahoma. Jarvis Moss. So now Moss against speech.
The moment we've all been waiting for.
Kyle, make your
own. No, you guys go first. I'm on my own.
Moss.
Right, I'm going to make the argument. The Moss block is the most memorable moment I have of ever being at a sporting event. I've heard a lot of stuff with basketball this year. I've seen a lot of cool stuff.
Nothing memorable from the basketball.
The South Carolina loss was a great play. That was really memorable. That was really cool. But the Moss block was the biggest play of that season by far. Without that, they don't even make it to the title game. That's by far the biggest.
I'm going
to
go one further. It's the biggest play in Florida football history. All you say it's the biggest play in Florida sports history. You can't name anything better to me than that.
I'm not even going to argue.
I'm going to go with Moss as well, actually.
Okay,
Kyle?
Here we go. I don't feel strongly about this at all. I think that it's very close in my mind. But in your guys' mind, it's not even close. I'm going to tell you why it is close to me. We didn't get to see what would have happened with that field goal if it got past the line. Now, Stuckup was a really good kicker, and he probably would have made it. I don't know. But none of us can say for sure that kick was going to go in.
His confidence was also shaken. They had two kicks blocked, one of them which wasn't his, I think. But
So his confidence is a little bit shaken. Also, just from the fact that even if he was perfect, we still don't know. We just don't know what would have happened there. With Tebow's speech, I'm saying that if he doesn't have that attitude, and he doesn't come out and say that, and he doesn't take to heart the loss that they had and really rally the team – there's no chance that they win a championship. Without Tebow taking on that attitude and inspiring the team, they do not win a championship. If Moss ends up not blocking that and the kicker just happens to miss, they still win the championship. So that's my argument.
Okay, here's the thing about the speech to me. He made the speech, and the next time they showed up on the field, they looked like garbage. Yeah. Until he made that touchdown pass that we talked about in the fourth quarter, which I don't think had anything to do with the speech. They didn't play hard. He didn't play harder than anyone. No one did. He may have played too hard. Maybe that's the thing with Tebow, since he never does anything wrong. If he's doing badly, then he's just playing too hard. Maybe that's what happened. The rest of the team wasn't trying hard. Nothing happened against Arkansas. They looked terrible until that touchdown pass. I think the speech is great. It's very memorable. We're going to talk about in a minute how far it's going to go down in history. But I think that the field goal block, I mean, that for sure had an impact on the game, which has been kind of your argument all along. I mean, what's in a bigger game, him in a press conference or Moss's field goal block?
No, I agree that it's a field goal block, but I'm saying that if Jarvis Moss doesn't make that play, it could still not go in. We don't really know. If Tim Tebow doesn't take on this attitude and this leadership ability that he showed, they don't win the title.
All right, well, Tebow already had the leadership ability. This speech has been blown way too out of proportion. I think the speech has become something he never even intended to be. He didn't sit down and was like, this is going to be the defining moment of this season. He was just answering a question in a press conference. He felt bad.
No, he didn't answer any
questions. He made the
over,
comment.
And he came back and said he just wanted to say one.
But do you think in his mind he was like, okay, this is it. It all changes right here? Or do you think he was just sad?
He was feeling like it was going to change right
but
here. The rest of the team does not necessarily.
That wasn't even a play.
This is, let me just say,
well,
this
if it wasn't even a play, then you probably should have knocked down the first shot if you didn't think it was that important,
no,
right?
But
no.
It was memorable. It was a moment. Okay,
but,
you're right.
Let's get to this. The Moss play is going to win here and probably online also. But going down in history, I think the Tebow speech, unfortunately, is going to usurp Jarvis Moss's field goal block. Does everybody agree with that?
Yeah. I do too. Just for the fact that it's associated with Tebow versus it being associated with
wrongly so, in my opinion.
And well, while we're on that subject, why it's going to go down in history. Last week, I'm walking to my car from class. One of my friends calls me. He goes, have you been by the football complex lately? And I'm like, no, but I'm standing right outside it now. He goes, well, go up and look on the wall. I turn around, I look, and there's a plaque with the entire Tebow speech after the Ole Miss game. Tebow's promise, it says the promise at the top is the day at the bottom. The whole thing is now etched on the side of the Heavener football complex outside the swamp. I wanted to cry afterward, not out of happiness. What do you guys think about it? I think it's kind of ridiculous.
I feel very strongly about it. This couldn't be any stupider. Like, first of all, this is not a good idea.
Neither could you.
Okay, whatever. First, you cannot, you're building a shrine to a player that's still in school. You can't do that. He was walking around in a shrine to himself playing these games. They couldn't wait 1 year to do this?
Does anybody disagree with that? Was this too early?
I don't think it makes a difference. I think that this is a cool thing that happened. The year's already over. That speech is so close. It's just that season that it was related to. It's not like he said something about his career or something that they put up there, or about the Heisman, or about the legacy. It was just that speech was directly related to the one season which already has taken place, and they went ahead and put it up there. I don't love it either way, but I just don't think it should inspire such a negative reaction. I don't think it's such a big deal that this is being made out to be by Defer.
I mean, I really don't care too much that it's up there. It is an important part in U.S. football history, and that is for the football complex. I do wish that they would have waited till he was out of the school that way. I mean, I don't see it going to his head, but at least there's no, like, you know, putting him above the team. But I don't really care that they put it up.
More so than that, to me, I just think it's corny and cheesy and lame that you do that immediately after the championship season. And also, if you're going to do it, why don't you put it inside where the trophies are and all the stuff? Like, put it in one of the videos that they have running in there. Putting it on the outside of the building, to me, is just, it's just weird. It's not cool. It's not like, people are going to go take pictures of it and love it, I'm sure. They're going to, you know, want to, like, trace their hand on it or something, but
that's my thing with it, was how it was done. First of all, when it was done, but then how it was done. It's up in, like, stainless steel, carved in. It looks like scripture up on the wall of the swamp. I mean, like, Kyle, what do you got?
I kind of agree with you. I don't know if this is the best way to do it. I think Mike's point's good about put it with the trophies, put it with the other stuff commemorating the season. But the speech itself was inherently cool. It was maybe the coolest thing I've ever seen from an athlete and the most inspired I've ever felt from an athlete because when I watched it, and I don't know if Bobby's going to cop this on the podcast, but Bobby and my roommate, New Kid, they mocked Tebow for doing this right after it happened, right after we watched it. They said, I can't believe he's crying, look at the attention, da 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 da. This is exactly what I want from every athlete who thinks, who claims to be a leader or claims to be the nation's best player, and especially from the quarterback position, when things go bad, for him to come out there and say, I'm going to fix this and not guarantee any wins. He did not say they would win another game the rest of the season. All he said is that his attitude was going to be incredibly focused, that he was incredibly hurt by what happened. You could see that he felt responsible, and he was taking the responsibility on himself. And that's all I ever want from any athlete. And the speech itself is one of the coolest things I've ever seen.
I was in the room when he said it, and I'll admit that I had goosebumps. I mean, it was ridiculous. Like, the amount of energy in that room, when he left, no one said a word for a few seconds. I mean, it was dead silent. In a room of reporters who, like, you know, talk themselves silly, it's ridiculous. There's this normally chatter like schoolgirls in there. And when he left, it was just dead silent. Everyone's like, did that really just happen? That's huge. But
that's how I felt. I mean, yeah, definitely.
But I mean, like I said, it's memorable. And it's one of those things that, like, if it's truly as memorable as they want you to believe it is by putting a plaque up outside the building, you don't need to put a plaque up outside the building. Everyone knows that Tebow did it. Put it in a highlight video. Do something like that. Sticking it on the outside of a building is just like, it's like cashing in on Tebow too much almost. Like, I don't know.
I want to go back to what you said about being in the room, because I remember in your column, and this was just when I was an Alligator reader, I was not working here or anything, you said you didn't know whether you wanted to like cry, scream, or just punch somebody out of all the energy you had in that room. I mean, that's something to be said for that. But
yeah, I mean, I think in the college, right, they're kind of exploiting T-Rose. I mean, is there, you guys don't see anything wrong with the athletic department doing this at all while he's still in school?
But I mean, look at what they, I mean, look at what everyone's doing.
What do you mean exploiting T-Rose?
Let me tell you this, all right? If you want to talk about exploiting T-Rose, everyone's doing it. Everyone does it to every good college athlete.
All the cool kids are doing it.
Yeah, all the cool kids are doing it. I was in Hale Village last weekend, and there was an art fair. There were pencil sketches of T-Rose's face for sale. There were paintings of a Florida Gators helmet with the eyes and eye black strips with Bible verses on it for sale for a lot of money. Then there was a painting, get this, I'll tell you the price at the end. There's a painting in a store above the cash register. Go on a treasure hunt. If you can find where this is, send me an email. It's called Lord of the Swamp, and I believe it takes place in the swamp, which, as one of you pointed out to me, is historically inaccurate.
Yeah.
Because they're playing Oklahoma, and he's like running through Oklahoma players. He has the Bible verses on his eye black strips. I believe there's one in his arm and maybe one somewhere else, so it's religiously inspired. The price tag on this painting, $6,500.
That's exploitation. Yeah. That is exploitation.
That is unbelievable. Do not buy that picture. Or buy and burn it. I mean, whatever you want to do. That's ridiculous.
No. Don't give the guy the money. Man. Just burn it. Steal it and burn it.
The real question is, when is there going to be a statue of Tebow put up on campus?
Is there
5 years
after?
Is there any 10 years after?
Next season?
Yeah, and I read somewhere, like, someone was talking about, you know, ways to leave little kiss marks from Tebow all over campus, like putting eye black strips on all the statues, Bible verses on it, and things like that. I think this needs to be done. This plan needs to be put in place. Let's do it right now. Let's start doing it right now. Tebow-fy campus as soon as you
This are. Is so ridiculous. So at what point does this all just go way too far with the Tebow love? Like,
it never will. I mean, I've been watching this since I was in 10th grade when I was at Nice, and it just keeps getting exponentially worse and worse and worse. I mean, I was in California on a school trip when I was a senior in high school. And this kid, we met some kids from Matt Stafford's high school. And they were like, oh, you're from Matt Stafford's high school, right? Because we saw their name. And they're like, yeah, they know Matt Stafford. And we're like, oh, well, we're from Tebow's high school. And they're like, who's Tebow? Who's that? Like, they really didn't know. And my friend goes and gets a USA Today, opens up the sports section, and he's in the sports section. There's a huge blown up picture of Tebow. And that's the moment for me when I realized how ridiculous this was going to get. And it's just gotten worse and worse and out of control.
Tebow's a legend. I mean,
it's not his fault. I don't blame Tebow. He's doing, he's a model citizen and athlete. He's, like you said, everything you can ask for and more from an athlete. It's not his fault, but it's way off the rails right now.
I'm going to say, my, like, this is outrageous Tebow moment is going to come for you actually rather recently. McCall, you and I were in Knoxville this year, the Knoxville Mall, for the Florida-Tennessee game. There's, in the Knoxville Champ Sports, I believe, there's a rack of Tim Tebow 15 jerseys.
All over the place, several stores selling
Tebow gear in the Knoxville Mall.
Now Knoxville is a more legit city than Gainesville in terms of size, but still,
there was a ton of it. It was more than just a jersey hanging on a rack.
He's transcended. He's not just UF football.
That's what I'm saying.
He's college football at this point. Anybody who likes college football and wants their kids to grow up to be an athlete wants their kid to be like Tim Tebow.
Even FSU fans that I've talked to that don't like Tim Tebow because he plays for Florida. Like, deep down, they like Tim
Tebow. Same with my friend at UCLA.
They want their kids to be just like Tebow, but with a little bit of better prospect of going to having a good NFL.
Okay, could you ever imagine selling, like, Peyton Manning jerseys in the Oaks Mall here in Gainesville? That would never happen in a million years.
They probably do. Not Tennessee.
But back in the day, like, while he was in college, or any other big college jerseys.
Is Knoxville just Tennessee the way Gainesville's just
no,
UF?
No, it's a bigger city.
So there you go. But there was
a ton of Tebow stuff. It wasn't just a lot. Like he was on the rack of, like, college jerseys in the collection. They had, like, specific Tebow racks.
Tebow is much larger.
Outrageous Tebow moment comes before the legend was built. And I think that's what's important. Bobby and I, like, when he first took over the starting job, when Chris Leak left, there was all this hype and all your friends were like, oh, Tebow's going to win the Heisman. And it was just completely unfounded. And when I found out that the Heisman shirts with the 15 on it were printed before the season started, to me, that was outrageous because the guy had never been a starting quarterback before until that season. And yes, he went on to win it. So all the same people are probably going to be like, oh, we told you so. But at that point, it just wasn't founded to make up Heisman 15 shirts, and I thought that was the most outrageous thing of the whole Tebow lore.
Yeah, I mean, as much as it was ridiculous for him to win the Heisman Trophy, and as much as I secretly, I mean, I was kind of torn. Like, I wanted him to because I want to see him succeed, but I didn't want him to because I didn't want it to get as out of control as it has gotten. At the beginning of the season, if you had put a gun to my head and said, "Will Tim Tebow win the Heisman Trophy?" I would have said yes.
Whoa!
Because this kid has done everything to like a higher level than I can even imagine. Like whatever your wildest expectations are of Tim Tebow, he's going to accomplish it. It's like, okay, well, Tim Tebow is going to come to Nice and make it into a legit high school football program and win a national championship. He'll go to a big school. All that's done. He's going to come in as a freshman at Florida, contribute, they'll win a national championship. Done. He's going to win a Heisman Trophy. Done. He's going to win another national championship. Done. He's going to blow off the NFL and come back, even though he wasn't going to be a first rounder. Done. He's going to win another national championship and another Heisman. That's what's going on now.
Done.
And if you're making me choose, I say done.
I would say
are
done.
You, are you saying right now that he's winning another Heisman next year?
Yes.
Okay. Wow. I would say Colt McCoy's probably the front runner, but
why?
I think
you got two guys coming back with a couple statues, neither one of them are named Colt McCoy.
Doubting Tim Tebow in any area of life is one of the stupidest things. It really is. And I mean, that's been proven. I don't like it. I don't like that that's a fact, but it is a fact.
I mean, my biggest moment where I realized this has gotten completely out of control is when the University Athletic Association posted on Gator Zone, "Fans, please do not ask Tebow for an autograph. He is trying to be a student." When that gets posted on the university's website, things have gotten out of hand. That it's that bad where they need to tell people to stop asking for autographs.
Yeah, and we're living in a city and in some kind of reality where the school has to do that for a student athlete. I mean, it says it all.
About one person and one person only. So, I mean, he's transcended everything else here. All right, I think we're done with the football stuff. Once again, go to spring practice today, yesterday, get in your time machine, whatever it was Kyle said. All right, and now with that, we're going to move on to some talk about the men's basketball team. Their season ended last night with a loss to Penn State at the O'Connell Center. Deifer, walk us through what took away your potential trip to New York here.
Yeah, you know, I don't ask for much. Me and Mike McCall were all ready to pack our bags to go to the Big Apple, and I couldn't even get this done for me, but it's all right. They lose to Penn State tonight. Jamal Cornley, Penn State's small forward, goes for 23 points, 12 rebounds. They had no answer for him. Cornley actually was playing his first game back after separating his left shoulder against George Mason. Kyle's George Mason in the opening round of the tournament. He did not play against Rhode Island, but he comes back tonight and torches the Gators. Kind of characteristic of the way things have been going all season. It was a close game. They could never really take over. Every time they matched or got a little bit of a lead, Penn State took it away again. Penn State went on a big run in the last minute of the game. They had back-to-back baskets, and they made 6 foul shots in the final minute, kind of ice thing. So Florida season, sadly, has come to an end, and it was a kind of rough way for the Gators to go out in the NIT.
I'm going to say it's not sad at all. I'll tell you what watching the Penn State game was like for me. You'll appreciate this, Kyle, because you probably read it. Didn't Bill Simmons write a column about how he had like a dog who was really old? He used to throw tennis balls to
the dudes. But don't you dare disrespect
him. He threw like one last toss to dudes, and then they went and put him down. That's what this game was like to me. This was one last toss to dudes. It was let's bring the Florida basketball team back out, parade them in front of their fans, let's have some fun, keep it kind of close, and then put them out of their misery.
It's Walter Hodges last game.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Jack up an awful three at the end of the game. Game over, season over. The dudes is dead.
I mean, yeah, once again, late, Nick Calathes wasn't taking the big shot. Irving Walker tried to and failed. It kind of sums up everything. I will say this about the Florida basketball fans tonight. They were very good tonight. It was pretty good attendance. I'm not sure what the listed was, but I'm going to say 6,000 or so. They were very loud. When Florida looked like they had a chance to be in the game, they showed up.
6,000's good?
NIT
game. For the NIT, sure.
Half full for the last game of your season, sending off your winningest player. I love it. Great. Good showing up, fans. You actually did exceed my expectations in all series.
Mike did get hopes up at one point in the game after Dan Werner's steal and put back. I believe he was looking forward to how they would actually win the game before I reminded him that, or are they just going to finish off this game like every other close game and just blow it?
Well, I had two things to say about this game. One was that was the best 10 seconds of basketball Dan Werner's ever had in his 3-year career. And it just so happened that it came while I was on the phone with Adam talking very seriously about a story that I had written and some changes that we had to make. And everyone in my apartment's going nuts and screaming about Dan Werner showing signs of being a real basketball player for the first time in 3 years.
I actually heard that in the background, yeah.
Yeah, so great job, Dan Werner. That's how you'll be remembered. And the other thing I wanted to say is, I think Mike owes me a thank you on air here for saving him money because I talked both the mics out of buying plane tickets to NYC. True. Before the game started, I said Penn State had a chance to win. They didn't seem to think so, and they ended up winning.
I mean, this is all money me and Mike can use for our trip to Seattle to see the Sounders later this year.
Amen.
So a big thank you,
though. But look, my potentially buying a plane ticket really was not based on anything having to do with Penn State. I can't name you one player. Although I believe one of their last names is Pringle. Is that correct?
Yeah. Okay. Like the chip.
That's all I had. So I didn't know what the matchup was. I just wanted to go to New York. I would still go to New York if I had a plane ticket. Screw class. Just
I'm going to put it out there. If Mike actually bought a ticket with his luck, they would have made it to the
It's your fault then.
Yeah.
It's a fair. Well, I'm happy.
Yeah, I'm going to go and say, Mike, maybe jinx them. I mean, you bought that ticket. We're probably on our way.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're going to start watching The Wire with you next week.
We've already decided I will now fill the void of my life left by the basketball season ending with The Wire, which I hear is the greatest show ever, but I'm skeptical. So
we've all been told him.
Stanley Pringle, you mentioned before, had 15 points tonight. He actually played really well. Okay, the other thing I want to talk about is this is Walter Hodges' last game. He's the winningest player in the history of Florida basketball. I got a chance to talk to him a little bit after the game in the locker room. I have to say, there's not a nicer guy than Walter Hodges. I know that he's had a rough year a little bit. He hasn't been the same since they won the title his sophomore year. But not a nicer guy than Walter Hodges. I wish him all the best luck in the world, and hopefully maybe he can scratch together a European career, maybe the NBA or something. But
you dealt with him on a regular basis, but the couple times I covered the team, I felt like he kept it real. Like, he came out and, like, you asked him some questions, and he gave you some real answers. It wasn't just, like, for instance, the Georgia game that I happened to go with you to when they lost the catastrophic loss to Georgia. And I asked him at the end, were you guys a little bit tired at the end of the game because you couldn't really make a basket from the style of play? You said, and he's like, no, we weren't tired. Georgia was tired. Those guys were tired. And, like, that's what we like as reporters. So was he like that the whole year?
Absolutely. Walter gets a little bit of a bad rap from reporters sometimes because he has a heavy Spanish accent. He's a little bit hard to talk to.
Prejudice.
No, but Walter really did tell you the way he felt. And you could tell he wasn't really sold on this team's chances this year. He tried to stay upbeat, he tried to stay positive, but he was always honest about it. He knew things weren't going well, and he said it.
Mm-hmm. I don't really think he gets a bad rap from reporters. It's not like everyone's running around talking trash about it. But I'll give you an example of his Latin-ness coming out in full force. Last year when I went to Vanderbilt to cover that game, I think maybe Walter had a technical or something called on him late in the game, or some kind of foul where, like, the other guy hit him, and then he hit back, and they called it on Walt. And after the game in the tunnel, I remember people asking him about it, and he was so honest and clear. He was still obviously very fired up about it. You could understand, like, every third word he said, but I love it. He was like, you know, that was BS. That was a joke. They never should have done that. I'm very angry about it. I felt like what I did was right, like, blah, blah, blah. And, like, you'll never hear that from anyone else. Like, football or basketball team, it's, like, rare that you get someone being that real with you.
Definitely. I absolutely loved him. I felt like he was a great player while he was here. He wasn't the kind of guy who's going to carry your team to wins or to titles, but he was definitely great on those title teams as coming off the bench as the first guard off the bench. And he was a good senior leader this year, I thought, for most of the year. Maybe not for his play, but for the effect he had on the younger guys. And down the stretch, I think he turned it on also.
Yeah, Walt was a great guy in the locker room. And the thing about Walter, I'm kind of remember, is actually tonight, they're down to Penn State. Things are kind of slipping away. And the look in his eye is something I'll never forget. He wanted to win this game so badly, and they couldn't get it done. I feel bad that he had to go out losing at home in the NIT, but he really did care about this program. I think that's how he'll be remembered.
I just want to go back. Did you say his Latin-ness?
Yeah. His Latininity. However you want to put it.
I like that one better.
I'd like to say that my buddy Pedro is going to be incredibly
MVP.
MVP.
All right, McCall.
All right,
One other thing I was going to say, it was kind of an awkward comment I picked up off the TV broadcast. Near the end of the game, they were all pumped up about Irving Walker doing something good. And they're like, that's Irving Walker, the heir apparent to Walter Hodges. I felt like that was maybe a little bit of a slight to Irving Walker because he does a lot more on offense. I mean, do you agree with that?
No, I don't think it's a slight. But I want to say one other quick thing about Walter Hodges. I think that I saw that, like, had he made the NIT Final Four, he would have been the only player to make a Final Four in all 4 years. And I'm glad he didn't get that dubious distinction because clearly these last two Final Fours didn't count. So I'm kind of glad that we didn't have like this big, like, oh, Walter Hodges made four Final Fours after the NIT was over.
Yeah, actually, in the locker room after the win against Miami the other day, someone asked him if he's thought about being the only player to go to four Final Fours. And he just laughed it off and said, it's not really the same thing, man. Yeah. So he knew it was kind of a joke. That's kind of a funny little story.
There's something to be said for succeeding in the tournament you're put in.
Oh, God.
I mean, I'm not saying that it's like a great record or anything, but it's not like an awful record.
No, it's not shameful, but I think nothing should be made of it.
I think Walter would have rather gone to two first rounds in the tournament, lost both of them in the NIT Final Four. Yeah.
I just got to say, the main thing that I'll always remember Walter Hodge for is one of our friends' hatred of Walter Hodge. Because he was such a huge Corey Brewer fan that if Walter Hodge was on the court, that meant that Corey Brewer wasn't. So anytime he saw Walter Hodge, he just absolutely hated it.
All right, and we're back. We just tried to go down another line of questioning there, but I asked Nefer a question. He absolutely froze, unlike anything I've ever seen before. There was profanity. I had to edit again. You guys are making me do work. This side of the table I'm looking at is just dropping F-bombs all over the place. So, Nefer, the end of the season is over. What do you take from this season?
Focus. Well, obviously, this team has left me speechless. This has to be a disappointment. I think Billy Donovan the other day said that he thought they underachieved this year, and that couldn't be further from
overachieved.
That couldn't be further from the truth. I think at the very least they should have made the tournament. They didn't get the development they wanted to from their freshman outside of Urban Walker and a little bit from Kenny Cagey. Nick Calathes faded down the stretch. Tyus was never completely comfortable at center. Warner had to play a lot of minutes maybe in a position he wasn't necessarily the most comfortable in. I think it was not a great season. I think there's a lot of things they can do to improve moving forward.
All right, I have a couple of questions here, though. There was a quote in your story about Donovan saying they were overachieving, where Tyus was like, really? He said we overachieved? All right, do you really feel like they overachieved? Like, the players don't believe that, right?
Yeah, they couldn't believe it. I asked Alex Tyus the other day, and he was like, yeah, really, they said that? And they couldn't believe that Billy Donovan even thought this. All the players thought there was a disappointment this year. They all knew that they underachieved. They realized what they were capable of, and the NIT surely wasn't it. So they all knew they underachieved. All
right, and then the second thing I wanted to ask you, once again, this team completely collapsed under the pressure. They did it last year. They did it again this year, despite all the, you know, things will be different talk. Is it just the pressure that this team can't handle? Because, you know, they come out those first couple of games in the NIT against admittedly inferior competition, but they looked fine. Like, they looked like a good team.
I don't think it was the pressure, and I think they just don't have enough good players. I mean, that's what it comes down to is talent. I mean, the teams they beat in the first two rounds weren't that great, and Miami was a decent team, but Jack McClinton played horrible. So I think it's they just can't get it done because they're not good enough.
All right, and where do we see this team going next year? We can talk a little bit about Calathes, but let's talk about where we see this team going next year, how we see them improving, where maybe they get worse. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously there was a huge crowd of reporters around Nick after the game tonight answering questions about the NBA and stuff, so we're not really sure where he's going to be. But going forward, their main problem is that they're going to have – they have three recruits coming in and only two scholarships. So somehow, some way, someone's got to go. Either Calathes leaves, maybe someone transfers. But that's kind of be a big theme this offseason, how they're going to deal with that. The same thing happened last year, and you had some transfers. Mo went pro. And
Jonathan Mitchell left.
Mo
went pro.
No pun intended.
Yeah.
But everyone's really excited about Vernon Mack, but that seems to be the theme going around the team. Donovan pointed out that he's in no way the savior or anything. Hmm. On the other hand, Dan Werner says that he's fantastic and he's going to make all the difference in the world. So I kind of tend to believe Dan Werner when he says that, and Donovan's trying to play down expectations. So maybe Macklin's a guy at like 6'10", 240, 250. That can be that inside presence they've been missing. So I think that's kind of where you need to look at Macklin maybe coming in and making a big impact.
That's what I was going to say, just as a presence inside, first of all. But then what he does for Tyus, maybe
absolutely
letting him move down to power forward. Let's go first of all. Do we think Calathes is going or not? Kyle?
I so strongly thought that he was going, and Defer like pwned me the other day because he's like, you haven't been looking at the draft, the predictions lately, have you? And I was like, come on, he's on the draft predictions. He was not on even the second round of the ones that we looked at.
Wow.
So that's really discouraging to me. I don't know. I feel like the people who do it, the draftexpress.com people or whatever the sites is that we went, whatever the sites are that we went to, that's what they put their time into is getting this stuff right. So I'm going to trust him. I say he comes back. I don't know.
Yeah. A month or two ago, I would have said he's halfway out the door already. I mean, earlier this season, he was projected as like a top 20 pick even in some drafts. But Kyle's right, he's fallen off the board completely. I believe ESPN the other day had him as one of the 100 best point guards behind Arkansas's Courtney Fortson.
That can't be right. 100?
He was in the list. He was not on either of the first two rounds, and he was on the list.
100 best players.
100 best point guards.
No, they can't be right.
I looked at the list today. He was the 13th best point guard.
Okay.
Like 30-something, 37 I think it was, best player, and they hadn't predicted late first round, early second.
I mean, on an 100 best point guard list, I think Hudson Fricke makes 99. So it couldn't have been that.
In all seriousness, though, this is a really deep point guard draft. So this net may play a factor in his decision. Donovan said he wants to have him back. But, you know, we'll have to see. It's, you know, Nick's going to make that decision in the near future.
Yeah, it's all about timing because this is, by all accounts, a very weak draft, the weakest in years. Yet the point guard pool is fairly deep, so it's kind of interesting.
So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. But what else are we expecting out of this year's team in terms of people coming in? You know, what are we expecting?
Kenny Boynton's the big name, the all-everything, five-star guy, supposed to come in and make a big impact. I think you have to look at him as the guy that can maybe turn things around, especially if Nick would leave. He would step in and play the guard position.
Eric Murphy. I don't know if you guys are familiar with him. He's like a 6'10",
entourage,
power forward. I think his first name's Eric. His last name's
Eric
Murphy.
It is Eric Murphy.
Okay.
I'll mention him briefly.
6'10", power forward, white guy, potential to be a Chandler Parsons type. But I think he plays more inside. He has a better inside game. Maybe not a banger yet, but somebody who, you know, come in and at least give him some more size in the front court.
His nickname will be E, correct?
No, Murph Dog. Yeah.
And the other guy is Deshaun Painter.
I'm calling him Murph
Deshaun Painter. I don't know a whole lot about him, but he's the other guy that's coming
another
in.
Another big body,
Bob says. So those are the three guys. They're obviously going to have to find a scholarship somewhere. I'm not sure the potential targets are maybe LeVar Cheney's obviously suspended. You'll have to see how that plays out.
Just take Herbs away.
Oh, you can't be serious. Urban Walker was by far their best freshman this year. We're not going to get into that.
Interesting thing for next year, though, guard play. If Calathis leaves, I mean, obviously we don't know anything about that yet. We'll have Boynton and Walker. Ugh. I mean, who's filling that? Kyle, you're disgusted by that.
No, I'm mostly kidding. Mostly. I think if Calathis comes back and it's Calathis and Boynton, that's formidable,
absolutely,
especially with the other guys that are going to fill out the lineup. I think if Calathis leaves and it's Walker and Boynton, then it's going to be which one of them is going to be the point guard, because I don't think either of them, despite Irv's size, are natural point guards. I think Boynton's a little bit more of a scorer. He has a little bit more of a scorer's mentality, and Irv's too. Irv's more of a shooting guard, if you ask me. I mean, he happens to be 5'8", but he scores the basketball, I think.
I mean, I think Irv has to be the point guard for those two, just for defensive reasons and because of his size.
Well, you can still guard whoever you want to when you come back down the court.
I think
I'm talking about an offense.
I think you're going to want to create shots for Boynton. I know he can make his own shot, but I think you're going to put him in a position to get him the ball. And
Irv as a spot-up shooter is probably a good idea. I don't know. Him taking wide-open three-pointers, I'm down with that idea.
Are you going to trust a freshman to run the team, though?
Yeah, heck yeah. I mean, if he's everything that they say he is, he's got all the talent in the world. I mean, let him do it.
And Kenny Boynton's made the comment that he can't see himself going to college for more than 2 years. So if that means anything, he should be great, right?
Enjoy these next 2 years while you get him.
And then the other point that you made, Adam, I think is really good, is that if Macklin plays center, that frees up Tyus tremendously at the power forward spot.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're going to see him have a huge year next year. Breakout year for Alex Tyus.
Yeah.
All right. And where do we see this team going? Like, what's the farthest this team can go? I know we're just ending this season, but I want to make some bold predictions.
We're looking way down the road, huh?
Yeah. So one of us can say that we were right like a whole year in advance here. So.
All
right.
Well,
what are we doing? Are we making predictions or are we saying what's their ceiling? Because it's different.
The ceiling's very high.
Yeah.
Let's do predictions.
Predictions?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Are we assuming that Nick's on the team?
How do we feel about that?
Yes.
I say yes.
All right. Until he's gone, he's on the team. It's like a Percy Harvin situation.
Nice. Yeah. Well
so,
said. Good.
All right. So if Nick comes back, you have Boynton, Tyus, Macklin, who are you going to throw out at three? Chandler Parsons. I think they're maybe an Elite Eight team.
Elite Eight team?
I think they have the potential to do.
No. What is your prediction? We define our expectations clearly.
I was about to say, I thought I was going to go high when I'm going to say they're going to make the Sweet 16.
All right. Well, okay. I think they have the potential to be an Elite Eight team.
Don't back off this.
Okay, I'll go Elite Eight. Although
there you go.
I think there could be a lapse. They can fall short of that. But I think Elite Eight's their ceiling.
No.
All right, I'm going with Elite Eight as my prediction.
Somebody
have to beat it out of
this
guy.
Channeling Phil Kegler. Because ceiling-wise, I think they could be a Final Four team. I think they have enough talent to be a Final Four team. I'm definitely not going to predict that. But I think if they put stuff together, Calathis comes back, Macklin's as good as advertised. Why not? SEC's weak. They'll get a good seed in the tournament. But I say they absolutely make the tournament next year. If Calathis comes back, they don't make the tournament, it is huge, big-time disappointment. Way worse than this season. Shameful, yes. So I'm going to say they make it, and I'm going to say they get to the Sweet 16. That will be my prediction.
Okay, since, like you said, this is going to be about coming back in a year and figuring out who's right and who's wrong, and if I say
no, that's not what this is about.
Well, it's making a bold prediction, seeing who can brag about it. And since you're all saying they're going to the tournament, I'm going to say they're not, so I can brag about it.
See, but that's ridiculous because
there's no way.
You're not going to get mocked mercilessly because you're not even doing this seriously. You're just doing this as like I'll come back and make fun of you guys in case this happens.
I think they'll be good, but it's almost hard for me to imagine them like having great success.
It was so long ago since they had.
If you're going to have Irving Walker and Ray Shipman coming off the bench and Kenny Cagey coming off the bench, you're going to all of a sudden have the depth they didn't have.
And Dan Werner.
And Dan, yeah, sure, Dan Warner would be great off the bench as a sixth man.
I agree.
I mean, the variables
or to on me, the bench as a sixth man.
That is a good drink, Dan Warner off the bench.
The variables, Dan Warner, the variables to me are just Boynton and Macklin. Because you know what you're getting with everyone else. I don't think it's going to be like a huge drastic improvement with
anyone. But also, you're going to have people playing back in their natural positions, which is a big deal. You're going to have Tyus, who gets to play the four, which is going to help him out. You're going to have Werner, who doesn't have to match up down low every time now. And I think that that's going to be a big deal for this team.
Werner will be fresh to shoot now since he doesn't have to work so hard on defense.
Working hard is his thing, man. No, but like Donovan said earlier this year, like this is a team of role players. Like, without really the star other than Calathes to really look to. And I feel like when this team can sort of become, you know, a team full of role players with, you know, three or four, like, players that they can count on to score every time down the floor, it becomes a whole lot better. So are you willing to back off of your ridiculous won't make the tournament prediction?
I want to stand by it just so I can say I'm right if they don't make it. But I don't really think they're bad. I think if they don't make it, it won't be because they're, like, a bad team. It'll be because they underachieve horribly, okay. Which I don't think is outside the realm of possibilities. I think there's still a decent chance that happens.
Okay. Now, if everyone stays healthy, they will for sure make the tournament. I'm saying that right now. And Calathes comes back.
They could potentially have a team with four starters that could play in the NBA if you're looking at Boynton, Calathes, Tyus, and Macklin. So, I mean, that's solid.
Yeah,
that's
sure.
All right, Bobby, give us a prediction real quick.
They will make the Sweet 16. That's my prediction.
Yeah. Wow. Setting it in stone real quick. Yeah. I'm going to say the same, actually. They will make the Sweet 16, and they will not win that game. So, Kyle, you had something else to say?
Well, I was going to say, I'm thinking maybe a second-round upset by Dayton now, but if that doesn't happen. I was going to say, especially like we were talking about guys playing out of position, Chandler Parsons is a three. He's the definition of a three. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Billy Donovan entertained the idea of him like playing the five, and he did at times play the four, is completely ridiculous. He's absolutely a three. Like, there's no question about it. Some guys are tweeners. He's not a tweener. He's a three, and it's just much better when Macklin comes in and they start getting more size, Murphy is another front court body, that these guys are going to be able to play their natural positions and they're just going to feel more comfortable out there.
In fact, for a brief stretch, he played the five tonight, I believe.
Unbelievable. Dan, that should never, ever happen.
And they lost.
And they lost.
So with the team that we're imagining right now, are they the best team in the SEC next year?
Yes.
Yeah, I agree.
Easily, I think.
Hands down, yeah.
All right, well, I think we're done with hoops talk, so we're going to move on. Just a couple quick mentions here. The women's basketball team ended its season tonight, unsurprisingly, with a huge loss to UConn. How good is this UConn team? Did anybody watch the game? That's ridiculous.
Said the biggest thing in college basketball this year would be UConn losing, and people are already talking about UConn as the best women's basketball team of all time, and they haven't even won the tournament yet.
Here's the thing, though. With women's basketball, teams go undefeated semi-regularly. UConn's done this before. Like, this isn't, like, such a new thing that, like, this never happens. This isn't like men's basketball. So that alone, I don't think puts them there. And those other teams, Diana Taurasi, they were better. I think they had a little bit more star power than the teams do now. You got Maya Moore, who's an incredible player for them, and Tina Charles is like ridiculous down low.
Stop it.
But, well, I actually watched some of the game today because I wanted to see if they were as good as I thought they were. And I actually turned it on when it was 26-20, so it was relatively close. And from then on, they went on this ridiculous run. UF couldn't keep up. I thought it was bad coaching by Amanda Butler, actually. She's done a great job, and I think Amanda Butler's a great coach. But Shea Brooks got into foul trouble, and she even picked up her third foul, and she sat her down. You're just conceding at that point because you cannot score with UConn without your best scorer and your best player, one of your best rebounders, on the floor. So if you put Shea Brooks in, you let her play through it, you tell her to be a little bit more careful, maybe she makes it through the game, maybe she doesn't. But if you sit her for 10 minutes at the end of the first half, you will not win that game or even keep it close, I guarantee you.
Yeah, and Brooks actually picked up two fouls, I believe, in the first couple minutes of the game. They were behind the eight ball from the start.
Yeah, two offensive fouls in the first minute and a half. Sat out for a little while. Came back in, which I thought was a little surprising. But then again, I mean, they wouldn't have even stayed in that game if it weren't for Brooks. And she had a rough game. But go ahead.
The UConn team is absolutely loaded, too. Like I said, I knew Maya Moore and Tina Charles going in. They were, like, the two big names. And then I was watching the game, and, like, their point guard went to the, like, had a four-point play. And the announcers were like, is she the best point guard in America? Like, some girl I've never heard of. And the other one's like, oh, yes, definitely. And I'm like, what the? That's like their third player, and it's the best point guard in America? Like, they're incredibly loaded. It's just not even the same. And what's even more ridiculous is they had a girl, I don't remember her name. She came in as the number one recruit, though, for this last season. She's supposed to be a freshman right now playing on the team. And she's supposed to be the LeBron James. She's white, but she's supposed to be the LeBron James of basketball. She's supposed to be the LeBron James women's basketball. She was made out to be this huge deal. She was supposed to win them four titles and be their star player. And as soon as she got to UConn, she had a couple practices. She was there for a couple days. And she may not have even practiced, and she called her parents up, and or she showed up at her parents' door, went home, said, I don't want to play basketball anymore. This is the number one recruit, the biggest recruit in the nation, saying, I don't want to play, like Greg Oden doing this, picture it, right, at Ohio State. And she now plays volleyball at Delaware.
Wow.
She has an Italian last name. I can't think of it, but go look it up. It's a really ridiculous story. ESPN did like an outside the lines thing on it. It was like kids getting burnt out because she was supposed to be this WNBA, can't miss, and she ends up going to Delaware to play volleyball.
If we're going to look at a little inside information on the Whoops team heading into next year, I actually went to high school with one of the girls who's going to play here next year. Her name is Jennifer George. She played high school basketball with my girlfriend. She's 5'10", but listed at 6'.
Nice.
That is inside information.
That is inside information. She's a good high school basketball player, but I'm going to say I was never, like, blown away by her. And if these are the kind of players that Florida's continuing to recruit, I'm going to say that I'm not sure if Amanda Butler is going on the right road.
I guess wow. Colleen wasn't friends with her then.
Someone's on the couch.
Could Colleen take her?
I mean, she's much bigger than Colleen.
So would it be a fair fight?
All right, so let's talk a little bit more. I know this probably is not – actually, this is definitely not the crowd to do this with, but what do we think of the women's team this season? They had a really good start, beat Tennessee, and then really just – sputtered out down the clutch there.
They did a good job. Amanda Butler should get all the credit in the world. She really did an exceptional job with changing the culture of this team, because whenever I would talk about UF sports to everyone, I would say, UF's the greatest sports program ever. All the teams are amazing, except for women's basketball is terrible. That's literally what I would say to everyone. You know, UF wins at everything except women's basketball is terrible. And this year that wasn't the case. There was no except. Women's basketball is also very good. And that's the biggest thing I take away from this season.
Yeah, Butler did a great job. She really did bring in good players this last year. Steffi Sorensen really gave them something, shooting the three this year. I think she did a good job.
What year is she in? How many years is she in?
Junior?
Who, Steffi Sorensen?
No, Butler.
Butler?
This was her second. So we haven't even seen the tip of the iceberg.
No.
This is what she's
great.
Doing with other people's players.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, the fact that she made the tournament is really impressive to me. I mean, they're not a joke anymore, which they were an absolute laughingstock before she got here. So, that's pretty huge for them to make the tournament, and now she's going to be bringing in her players. She's kind of a tough love type coach. She played the game. I mean, I think things are really looking up for the women's basketball program.
I mean, they had a great season. It was impressive. They made the tournament. They won a game in the tournament, but it still doesn't make me want to go watch women's basketball. And if they're ever going to be really successful, they have to change that. They have to have people wanting to go see them, and I don't see that happening.
That's a much different argument.
I mean, you can't. It's hard to get people to go watch men's basketball.
Yeah,
here, to be totally honest. So,
because they'll kind
that's not gonna happen. But the best they can do is just keep getting to the tournament, keep winning games. We had this discussion earlier. I want to see what everyone thinks about it. Is it better for Florida to make the tournament and go up against UConn and have a chance to beat them and really put themselves on the map, or to play somewhere else, maybe win another game or two, and then lose? Is it better to go another two rounds, or is it better to have a shot taking down the king?
It's definitely better to go another two rounds, because we amended this. Like I said, that if they were to beat UConn, if that was the conditional we were going off of, beat UConn or go to the Final Four in another region and then lose in the Final Four, beat UConn would have been bigger and more memorable. People would have remembered that and talked about it. It would have been a bigger moment in the tournament, so that would have been better. But for them just to get the shot and then get blown out the way they did, no, it's not better. They would have been better off going a couple rounds deeper.
Yeah, absolutely. One or two more wins would have been much better for the program.
Yeah, I think the loss to UConn actually hurt the program a little bit, just because that's one of the first times people get to see them on national TV, and it's them just getting romped by UConn.
Although,
it's not a very good image.
I'll make the argument the loss is almost negligible, because people figured UConn's going to kill everyone, so it almost doesn't even count.
Yeah, I think that's true.
It's worth noting they lost by less than the average margin that UConn beat its opponents 32? This whole year. So, yeah, they lost by
put that on the wall.
Yeah. And let's say something about Shea Brooks and Marche Johnson.
Absolutely.
Also, because we gave all the credit in the world to Butler, but those two players really did a great job in their time here. I always thought Shea Brooks was incredible. Dotson, I don't like the women's post play, because Marche Dotson's 5'10 and plays like a great power forward. So that there's something about that that always bothers me. But I mean, I guess she's been a great power forward in women's basketball. She had a great career here. She was a workhorse for them, and she did a great job.
All right, and let's move on from that to a real quick talk about baseball. They had a game last night. And then some big news out of the baseball team here, Kyle.
Yeah, they played UNF. They're doing a home-and-home with UNF. The other game is tonight, or in the time machine yesterday. It's Wednesday night.
It's
in
16 hours by the time we're recording, or less than that.
So they went to UNF, and they got beat 3-0. The lineup couldn't get anything going. UNF. It was 0-0 in the bottom of the eighth. UNF scored three, and that was pretty much it. It wasn't an exciting game. Nothing really great happened. Tony Davis led up the go-ahead run, but it wasn't really his fault. The offense needed to score. I've never seen anybody win a game scoring no runs. So.
And how many Riley Cooper strikeouts tonight?
I didn't count.
I
think it was
either one. I know he definitely struck out on his first at bat. Next two are flyouts.
Right.
I don't know what he did in his fourth. The big news, though, is that with the team for the first time all season was Stephen Locke, who was actually kicked off the team a week or two before the season started for getting arrested and charged with the DUI, but the charges have been dropped. And on Saturday or Friday, I believe, Coach O'Sullivan said that he was still unsure whether or not he would come back. And then he said, we're not even sure if he's ready to play yet, which to me meant he's definitely coming back. And, of course, as soon as the series is over, Stephen Locke back on the team.
Yeah, this is kind of big for them. I mean, you want as many arms as you can have. And Stephen Locke did show, I believe, in his freshman season that he's very talented. He's got what it takes. Then he had surgery, and his velocity really dropped off. He got his command back after a while, but he never was really throwing as much confidence as he did. He wasn't throwing as hard. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, after he wasn't able to come all the way back, then getting suspended, and then or then getting kicked off the team and now coming back after a wrongful DUI charge, I guess. I mean, how quickly is he going to be able to get back into it?
Well, his stats were really good last year. I mean, he went 5-2 with a 3.17 ERA. He made 12 starts, which was second on the team. And I think he had second most innings pitched also on the team. I'm not sure on that one if he was second or third. But he threw a lot of innings for them last year, and he was pretty effective. And I don't know how great he's going to be, but you can always use more arms, especially with this team. You could always use more arms in college baseball, so it's definitely going
to
help them.
All right, you guys are a lot closer to the situation than I am, but does Florida owe Stephen Locke like a huge apology for, like, I'm sorry we accidentally kicked you off
I think
team?
So, absolutely, because but I think just by letting him back on, you're admitting that you
absolutely.
Wrongfully kicked him off. I had this discussion with McCall. I think the right action would have been to suspend him until the thing cleared up, because I don't know if he did something wrong, but he probably did. They should have suspended him and then got all the facts straight and gone from there. So yes, I think they do owe Stephen Locke an apology.
I agree, but if I was to work him back in, I wouldn't let him throw right away into the weekend games. The weekend's SEC, not the best time to have him just thrown out there. You know, let him get some of those easy, you know, cupcake teams during the week, and then save his arm. For, you know, well, I mean,
they lost
two of those cupcake teams, yeah, but those should be the teams that they are winning easily.
Bring back to Kane.
Yeah, and then towards the end of the season, you have another fresh arm that's proven and has experience that they can now rely on later in the year.
Yeah, I agree. I wouldn't throw him into the fire right away, and I don't think O'Sullivan will. You may not even see him on the field for another 2 weeks or something like that until he feels like he's game ready, so...
All right, I think that about wraps it up for our show today. Go check out our bracket challenge. Keep your eyes on the leaderboard there. It'll be updated throughout the weekend. Also, listen to our Friday podcast. We might be doing another special from my living room. I don't even know. It'll be interesting to listen to, though. And then I think we have one more thing here. What's going on over here?
Just a little good night to Vincent. That's all. All
right.